This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks for tuning in today. More than a century ago, the Boundary Waters Treaty established an advisory group made up of representatives from the United States and Canada. Called the International Joint Commission, its charge is to attempt to prevent and resolve disputes over the use of the waters shared by the two countries. One of its latest projects is a study titled Lake Superior Regulation, Addressing Uncertainty in Upper Great Lakes Water Levels. The study examines the potential future impacts of climate change in order to better anticipate and respond to future extreme water levels. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz spoke with an atmospheric scientist who has immersed himself in the impact of climate change on Great Lakes water levels. Dr. Paul Rober, who also founded the Innovative Weather Program at UW-Milwaukee, says historically, the Great Lakes have had a significant range in water level.
It's just a natural variation that occurs. And there are a number of different cycles in the water levels that occur because of these natural variations. And it's tied primarily to precipitation trends. So the precipitation is the biggest driver for Great Lakes water levels. You have more precipitation during a period of time when that's promoted and the Great Lakes water level will rise. If you have less, then it will fall. And we've seen that, for example, in the 60s, it had a historic low level related to one of those trends. And in the, I think it was the mid or late 80s, we had a high level as a result of the opposite side of that precipitation trend. And there, we've done a pretty in-detailed study of these precipitation drivers for Great Lake water levels, and we found that there are actually two significant drivers. One is an 8-year cycle in precipitation, and the other is a 12-year cycle. And also, interestingly, because of that, there's something called intermodulation between those frequencies that occurs between the 8 and the 12-year cycle. And what intermodulation is something that everybody's familiar with. If you've driven down the highway past a radio tower and suddenly had your radio station jump from one to another briefly, that's intermodulation. And the same thing happens in these precipitation drivers. And that produces a 30-year cycle, which we've also detected. So even though there's not a direct driver of that 30-year pattern, those two interactions between 8 and 12 actually produce a 30-year cycle. So you've got all these long-term variations in water levels related to precipitation.
So how far back can you look at those cycles?
That's a really good question. The 30-year cycle is actually pretty long based on the historical record. We only have a little over 100 years of water level records. It was just enough using some fairly sophisticated tests that we've done to be able to establish that it was statistically significant. And we've also seen confirming reports from geological studies, which have used a different approach to try to isolate that. So it's all consistent with everything that we've found. So we know that those exist. Turns out the 8-year cycle is related to wintertime precipitation. So when you think about the big winter storms coming through, that's what's driving the 8-year cycle. So when you have a time period in which it promotes a storm track that's coming over the Great Lakes as opposed to missing south or missing north, then we tend to produce more precipitation over the basin and the water levels will rise. And the 12-year cycle turns out it's related to the other type of precipitation we get here, which is summertime thunderstorms. And there are particular types of weather patterns which promote more or less thunderstorm activity. And so that's a 12-year cycle that we get. So a lot of different physics going on that are driving those natural variations in water level.
So what about the unnatural effect of climate change?
So climate change is something that has really started to have an impact only recently, and it's related to the opposite of precipitation, evaporation. And we've seen a 25% change in evaporation, specifically an increase, since the 1980s, related to the warming of the atmosphere, but especially of the lakes. Lake Michigan now tops 80 degrees in the summertime fairly routinely, and this year it hit 80 earlier than it ever has before. Back 30 years ago, it was in the upper 60s. That was a pretty warm temperature for Lake Michigan. So we've really seen a significant increase in the lake surface water temperatures. And there's a particular physical process which is driving that too, which is tied into the climate change effect, which is really amplifying. If you look at what the air temperatures have done here, they've warmed, but not nearly to the degree that the lake has. So the lake has really amplified that response, and that drives evaporation. So evaporation has increased tremendously since the 1980s. So we're losing water that otherwise we'd be gaining. Right now we're in more of a, except for the summer, we've been in a higher precipitation trend. So you'd expect if we adhered to the natural variations that would lead to increases in the lake water level. But because the evaporation has also increased so much, we're actually at fairly close to historic low levels in the water levels.
Can you talk a bit about the Joint Commission study?
I am actually not really conversant with the International Commission's work. I do know that there's been a lot of attention paid to dredging further down in the Great Lakes system and the effect that might have, essentially opening a drain to pull out water. I haven't looked specifically at those studies, but at least from a cursory examination, it seems plausible to me that has been a contributing influence to a drop in water levels, but it's basically, you know, a one-time drop to a certain level, and what we're seeing is something different from that. And the amount of change associated with dredging is minor compared to the effect we're seeing from evaporation. So it's really these big picture climate change drivers that are really changing the game, so to speak, on the Great Lakes compared to what it was 30 years ago. So that swamps the effect of the dredging. And so if you ignore that, you're ignoring the key question. And we don't know at this point what the top end of that evaporative loss really is. Is it something that continues to increase, or does it stabilize at a certain level and we just equilibrate over a new lower level for the Great Lakes? And that's something that research can probably answer. In fact, a colleague and I are working with scientists at Madison on a new NSF-funded grant to actually look at that question, try to understand it better.
This is maybe too broad, but you know, you can't help but think of the major water issues that affect regions of the world, and the school here's mission to help to address some of those problems, either water scarcity or water or too much water. So how does your research and the work that you do, how does that all fit?
Our charge is really not just what's literally outside our back door, Lake Michigan, but lakes throughout the world. For example, one of our scientists, Harvey Bootsma, for a long time has done work on Lake Malawi in Africa, which is another large lake system, and I've collaborated with him on some of that research. We now have a new director for the Center of Water Policy, Jenny Keel, and so she's bringing in some of the policy and economics impacts to play into this. So what was more of a biologically centered research group is now much broader based and more able to take on these more significant questions related to water use and water rights and water policy.
It's kind of interesting because I just jotted a note that the International Joint Commission came to life in 1909 through the Boundary Waters Treaty, and as a way to try to resolve any conflicts between the two countries around. You know, it's just so interesting, and now the world has changed so much and the issues have become much more acute, or at least people are realizing them. Right. So it's just all sort of an interesting web, isn't it?
Well, you know, some of the things have changed and some haven't. So, for example, climate change is something we're dealing with now that we didn't really have to the same degree, at least in those years. But boundary issues for water have always been around. And Jenny Keel can cite you chapter and verse as to how that's an issue and has always been an issue and always will be an issue. But what's different is when you have an overriding influence, as, for example, from climate change, and there's nothing, you know, one particular country, there's nothing one country can do to alter that. That's really something that takes a global effort to do something about.
So it sort of forces collaboration if we can pull it off.
Yes, I think that's a good way of putting it, if we can pull it off, yes.
So can you talk a little bit about the research that you're now undertaking with a couple of other colleagues? Can you talk about how you go at that research?
Sure. So what we decided we needed to answer is why Lake Michigan, for example, is warming as rapidly as it is. And it's not unique to Lake Michigan. In fact, all the Great Lakes are doing this. Lake Michigan and Lake Superior are the two fastest warming lakes, and they also happen to be the deeper lakes. And we think that the process that's occurring is that as the lakes warm, because of the atmospheric driving, the atmosphere is warming, that warms the lakes. The lakes go through a whole physical overturning process during the spring and the fall months, and then it goes under what's called a stratification. So in the spring, after that initial overturning occurs, the surface waters are exposed to the sunshine, and then that warms up the surface waters. The deep water stays cold, but the surface waters warm up quite a bit. And if that process occurs earlier in the year than it used to, because the warming is occurring earlier, and that is the case, it's occurring several weeks earlier than it used to now, then you have a much longer time for the warm summer and the sunshine from the summer to actually operate on those surface waters and jump up the temperature. Now, we looked at that, and we found that that by itself, just from a radiation budget calculation, is not enough to account for all the warming that's actually occurred. And so our hypothesis is that there's also a change in cloud cover, especially low cloud and fog. As the lakes warm, there's more heat coming from the lakes than ordinarily is the case, and you get less cloud cover, less low cloud, less fog than you otherwise would. What happens if you take out the fog? More of that sunshine hits the water and gets absorbed and warms it up faster. We've done some preliminary modeling calculations to see if that physical idea actually is verifiable using a relatively simple model, and we found that it is. So now what we're doing is turning to a more sophisticated approach where we can really account for some of the secondary effects to see if that still holds. I suspect that, our answer is that, yes, that is what's going on. Kind of intrigued by the results that we were showing, a colleague of mine in the atmospheric sciences group started looking at lake temperatures throughout the northern hemisphere, and he's seeing that this is happening everywhere. So it's not just the Great Lakes either. It's all the lakes in the northern hemisphere are warming much more than the air is warming. And it's likely the same kind of process that's occurring.
Does that research involve modeling and statistics? I mean, just all kind of crunching numbers and compute, yeah.
It's both, yeah.
So are you sticking, you're not sticking fingers or testing devices in the water?
Well, ultimately, you know, what drives any answers you have are what we would call ground truth, or in this case, sea truth. You know, observations. You need to have observations to really anchor any kind of results you're finding. And so everything that we find has to be consistent with what we're seeing in the observations, and so far it is.
Dr. Paul Rober is a distinguished professor of atmospheric science with the UWM Department of Mathematical Sciences. He also founded and administers the forecasting initiative within the Innovative Weather Program. He spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz. This fall, Rober is taking on yet another position as Associate Dean for Academics for the School of Freshwater Sciences, where he is already working with students and scientists. There are links to more information about the work of the International Joint Commission and its Upper Great Lakes report from WUWM.com/lake effect. A quick break now, and then an essayist considers how gymnastics changed her life. That and more when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.